things that you will be hearing at times, maybe you've already heard this in your Christian life, is that, oh, those terms, that all that systematic theology and the stuff that you get in the creeds, especially the Westminster Confession and the Doctrine of God, they're all philosophy terms. They're not Bible terms. We want Bible terms. And if you were to see the amount of liberal theology that has come in through that opening in the tent of theology, you'd be amazed. And you will beware of what we might call biblicism. Now, it's interesting. We think, well, biblicism, the Bible is our foundation, right? It's the only infallible foundation for the Christian faith. It's the very Word of God. So what do we mean by biblicism? Well, what we mean by biblicism is to say that only the words in the Bible can be used to describe the truth of the Bible. And immediately, what word would come to mind that is not in the Bible? The Trinity. Do we believe in the Trinity? Oh, yes, we do. It's the most fundamental doctrine of the Bible, that God is triune. That is actually not a philosophical term. It's a theological term that was invented to describe what is clearly taught in the Bible, is that God is one God in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And so there is a word that is not in the Bible, but it describes biblical truth. And clearly, we've borrowed from philosophy some of the words that we use to describe God. And we think especially of those incommunicable attributes, that God is infinite, eternal, and unchangeable. Those are all what are called incommunicable attributes. That is to say that those words describe God in a way that is uniquely God. We will never be infinite, eternal, and unchangeable. We will never be that. And so notice that they all are what are called privative words. That is to say that they're put in the negative, that to say infinite means that he is not finite. And guess what? Paul uses those very words. In the Greek, these are called alpha privative. And instead of the I-N or the E, they have the A, the alpha. The first letter in the Greek alphabet is used in order to say that God is not such and such. And here it is: to the King of ages, immortal, invisible, the only God, be honor and glory forever and ever. So immortal and invisible are both alpha privative words. They're philosophical words, and they simply are saying that God is not subject to mortality, and he is not subject to human sight. Immortal, invisible. And so infinite, eternal, and unchangeable. Same category. Don't let anyone tell you that we have based our theology on Greek philosophy, because that is simply rubbish. And I get animated about this because I've seen the way people can manipulate biblical truth through that door. And if you go back, they'll actually take a huge swipe at all of the theologians that we count to be the greatest theologians after the magisterial reformers, which would be that main generation of reformers of Luther and Calvin and Beza and Zwingli. Those are the magisterial reformers. And they'll go back to that and they'll say, oh, those are the real biblical theologians. Of course, they used these terms as well. But based on that first big generation of reformers comes the post-Reformation Reformed theology or theologians. And guess what? That's the Puritans. They were sort of the capstone of that generation. There are several generations. There are actually three main periods of post-Reformation theologians. And they fleshed out what we call the Reformed faith. And so you have John Owen and William Perkins and so many of the different theologians that were there sitting on the Westminster Assembly. And so they're often been written off as being scholastic. That's the nasty little way of describing them. They're scholastics. That means that they dabbled in philosophy, wondering how many angels can you fit on the head of a pin and that sort of nonsense. And that has nothing to do with their theology, because if you look at those post-Reformation theologians, what you'll see is that they were the consummate exegetes. That is to say, they were students of Hebrew and Greek, Old Testament, New Testament. I know, a little Aramaic too. And they were there going to the Bible and drawing all of their theological constructions from the Bible. And they didn't want to hear about stuff that came from any other source. This was their bottom line, their foundation, their fountain of truth. And so just a little warning out there in case you hear people carping about scholasticism. Those post-Reformation theologians are among the greatest men to ever reflect on Scripture. And our Westminster Confession and Catechisms are the best testimony to that fact. In fact, one of the things that I'm thinking of doing, and you might pray for my wisdom and our wisdom as a session on this, because we decide these things together, is that after Landon finishes his, and he's going to get into the heart of what he's been doing about the intertestamental period to show us how it shows up in so many places in the New Testament. And after he's done with that, which is probably a 12 to 15 week conclusion, I'm thinking of going to the Westminster Confession and going through the whole confession in summary fashion. So, here we are. God is a spirit, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. That's a question worth memorizing. And that's what this whole book of J.I. Packer is about, knowing God. Only remember what we were saying at the very beginning when he uses the illustration of travelers and someone in the balcony looking down as the travelers are on their journey, and the balconeer, as he calls them, the balconeers are looking down, and they're going to ask the question, why did God allow sin to come into the world? And the travelers, the pilgrims, are going to be asking the question, how can I deal with sin in my life today? Okay, so it's eminently practical, but it's no less theological. I think that's one of the beauties of this book, is that he doesn't say, oh, we want practical stuff, we don't want theology. No, not Packer, because he had immersed himself in these post-Reformation theologians and theology. And so he wants to show us how theology, good doctrine, biblical doctrine, the doctrine that's been enumerated to us in our confession and catechisms, is eminently practical. And so we have a question then, how does the Bible use the word majesty? And how does this contrast with modern thoughts about God? Maybe what we should first ask is, what are modern thoughts about God? What is he covers that in the book? What are the ways in which modern people tend to think about God? Or less. Right. Exactly right. That's a good terse way of saying it. He's equal to us. In other words, we humanize him and we want to make him compassionate and like us and friendly. And also, at its worst, at our disposal, okay, that's the way that we tend to think about God in the modern world. And so we diminish him. And that's why the famous book, Your God is Too Small. I'm trying to think of who that was. It was a Bible translator, actually, that wrote that book. It's Phillips, that's right, yeah, J.B. Phillips. And Phillips did, a New Testament translation. So, what does the Bible say then? And it was amazing to me. In fact, I meant to do this morning and I forgot to do it, to look and see how many times in the ESV does the word majesty show up. But it's not difficult to find loads of verses, Old and New Testament, where the word majesty shows up. And so, Psalm 93:1, the Lord reigns, he is robed in majesty. And then 145:5, on the glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous works, I will meditate. Now, this is interesting to me because these are different words for majesty. They're different Hebrew words. So there are several words that are used. And I enjoyed looking at the one in Psalm 93 that he is robed in majesty. And this is geut. Sounds like bulut. Geut, from the root for rising. And so there's the sense that I guess could refer to growing of a plant, but particularly of the growing of an empire or the rising of someone who is powerful. We can remember seeing this in the life of Barack Obama. We've seen him come out of nowhere pretty much into the Senate from Chicago and suddenly Before you know it, he is the President of the United States. That is a rising to power. And so that's the idea, majesty, glory, vitality, and strength. And so the way that we could sum this up is that it's simply a way of saying how great God is. His majesty is his superlative greatness. And it's one of the most wonderful words, actually, in the English language to describe God. And, of course, well, we think of it through history or maybe watching Downton Abbey. We think of majesty, and that's what the queen or the king is called, majesty, or your majesty. And so why? Because in terms of humanity, they are in positions of greatness and glory. And so God is the King of kings and the Lord of lords. So we see that human greatness, that human glory, but now the greatness of God far transcends the greatest of human beings. There's a type of poetry, I'll mention this in the sermon this morning, called Ubi Sunt, and it literally in Latin means, where are they now? And it is a reference, of course, to our mortality, and someone who is rising to greatness in human life, a few years, they die, and black night doth take away our mortal reality. And so Ubi Sunt reminds us that even the greatest of great human beings are subject to mortality. And that ought to leave the rest of us in a very humble position. And so those modern ideas of God bear no resemblance, really, to the biblical idea of God's amazing majesty. Now, in the New Testament, it shows up a number of times as well, but here in 2 Peter 1, we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. That's an amazing statement. What were they eyewitnesses of? What did they see, Peter and the apostles? They saw Jesus, right, and they saw him in the transfiguration is what that's specifically referring to. And so they saw him in his glory now, but it was in human revelation of that glory. In other words, it was Jesus, his being, in a way that it never was before the incarnation. He had taken to himself a full and complete human nature, yet without sin. And then it was not just a complete human nature, but it was one that went from this life, from this fallen, mortal human nature, to a glorified human nature. That is, bringing humanity, made in the image of God, to its culmination, to its glorious goal, which was there in the Garden of Eden, but never achieved because of the fall of Adam. And so the sinless one took on mortality in order to win glory. And he is therefore referred to as God majestic and almighty by the Apostle Peter. And so wow, what a statement that is. And it's interesting, in the Greek, the word is megaleoitetos, megaleoitetos. And we get that word mega, you know, mega bucks is when you have millions of dollars in the lottery. And so mega describes his greatness, his superlative greatness. And it's interesting, why is it that we think so highly of ourselves in the modern world? What is it about modernity in particular? Now, I know that we've always been sinful, we've always been proud, ever since the fall of Adam, all of that is true. But what particular reality is there in modernity that seems to almost support, I say almost support, it seems to support the greatness of man, of humanity? What is it about the modern world? Inventions. That's a perfect way to sum it up. Now, God made us to be inventive, to be creative. He made us to be that way. And so that in itself is not a bad thing. Problem is that when we divorce ourselves from God, when we're separated from God, then our inventiveness could lead us to believe that we are somehow superior, that we don't need God. And we have invented so many things to occupy us in the modern world that it's almost as if there was nothing up above us or beyond us. And so now we're actually, I see this constantly in reading the newspaper, even a conservative newspaper like the Wall Street Journal is constantly coming up with these articles about the brain can explain everything about our humanity. Now, it also has a number of articles that contradict that, so there is some balance there. But the idea that everything can be reduced to physical nature, if that's true, that means that we can manipulate it all and that we will be in ultimate control. And the whole doctrine of majesty says, I am in control. There is no God like me. Where in the Bible do we actually see that long before our inventions took over in the Industrial Revolution? Where in the Bible do we see the repetition? It's in many places, but there's one particular place where you're constantly seeing the Lord saying, I am the Lord, and your idols, well, their inventions, they are futile. They are nothing. They are not going to prevail. Where in the Bible does that seem to be repeated over and over again? Oh, Job, okay, 38 through 41. In fact, one of the things that someone suggests in one of the studies for this book is that we do a dramatic reading of that. Maybe we'll have time for that, I'm not sure. But Isaiah would be the great prophet that the Lord is asserting his majesty through Isaiah. Now, he does it through all the prophets in different ways. But there are so many different places where he basically says, I am the Lord. Get this straight. I'm in control. Because before technology, what sinners did is they made idols. And what are idols? They're supposed means of controlling, particularly the forces of nature. And so fertility, human fertility, and then crop fertility, and those sorts of things, the cycles of sun and moon and the seasons, all of that was thought to be controllable. Magic, of course, has that same conceit that the world is controllable through certain spells and formulas. And we have a different kind of magic, as Steve Jobs used to remind us when he would introduce a new Apple product, especially the iPad, which was his magnum opus, that this is magical. And there's a sense in which it is. We can't understand how it works. Just recently, they had an upgrade, which I find relatively annoying because it usually interrupts you in the middle of something that you're doing, and it takes a long time to download. And the upgrade came on. If you have an iPad, you know that when you push the home button, everything either goes back to home or it pops up. And so it was jerky after OS 8.0, maybe it was, or 1. But it was jerky. It went like that, and you went, oh, this is not an improvement. This stinks. And so just the other day, I downloaded it yesterday afternoon. They had an upgrade. Well, it was much quicker, of course, because they probably had thousands of complaints about this jerky movement. And it just, it hesitated. It wasn't, there was something fouled up in the system. And so sure enough, this fixed the system. But I don't know how they did that. I can only imagine the hundreds and thousands of lines of code that they have to manipulate to make changes. And it's mysterious. It's a way of controlling the world. There's a wonderful article in this week's Wall Street Journal by Nicholas Carr on automation. He's recently written a new book on automation, and he shows how many important human functions have been taken away from us through automation. Now, the fact that we don't have to stop at a toll booth and pay a toll and can drive right through and pay it automatically, electronically, that's one of the wonders. To me, that's a good thing. We're not stealing anything from anyone who doesn't have to sit in that booth and make change all day, as far as I can see. But there are other things. Think about the function of mathematics. I force myself to do the subtraction in my checkbook just so that my brain will stay functioning properly in terms of adding and subtracting figures. And, of course, sometimes I make a mistake, and I find that out when I balance it every month. But the fact is that's something that's been taken away. Now, what happens if we get, and now there's a threat to our grid, and they're saying that there could be a major cyber attack by an enemy that would shut down pretty much everything. How would you do without electronics? Could you add a column of figures? That's just one simple example of the kinds of things that might be taken away from us. But anyway, our conceit is that if we can control everything, then maybe we'll be able to actually overcome death, because our life expectancy is expanding now considerably. Loads of people living to be over 100. And so we live with that conceit that we can control all things. Ultimately, just given enough time and enough technology, and this, of course, is a great, great lie. And so when we stress that God is personal, okay, I remember one of the great things Francis Schaeffer would always say, that the God of the Bible is the infinite personal God. And I like that combination, infinite personal, not just personal. What's the problem with that one side of that, taking just the personal side? This is, I guess, somewhat of an obvious question in light of what we've just been saying. What are we eliminating if we just emphasize his being personal? Yeah, he's kind of our sidekick, and he's there to help us when we need help, but we're sure not going to take sovereign direction from him. And so we want to always say, well, we don't want to eliminate the fact that he's personal, because there's a lot of theology out there in the world that has God so distant from us. Deism, which is interesting. That was the Industrial Revolution and deism. I don't know if there's ever been a study to relate the two, but as we become more adroit in our ability with machines, God becomes more distant. And in fact, the model is that God sets us up. He's the great watchmaker. He designs the watch. He builds the watch. He winds it up, and then you're on your own. And so God is at a distance. But we want him to be personal in as much as, and this is where Christian Smith's work in teenage religious sociology has been so important, that moralism and deism go together. And what we do then, and you find this in youth culture in particular, is that God is there to help me when I need him, but he's not forming the way that I live. So that's the problem of making him personal but not sovereign, personal but not majestic. And so he spends quite a bit of time here going over that difference. And when we leave him as just personal, Packer calls him weak, inadequate, ineffective, a little pathetic. In other words, this is not the God of the Bible, who is both personal and majestic at once. And so then when we talk about these twin truths about God, how are they revealed at the beginning in the opening chapters of Genesis? How do we see that God is both personal and majestic in the opening chapters of Genesis? What does he say? The personal actually begins. And in my lectures that I'm actually working on developing more of this now as I get ready for a January week out in Escondido teaching, that the personality begins with God, and that his tri-personality is essential because persons must interact with other persons. And we have that ultimately, infinitely, and eternally in the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The intra-Trinitarian relationship is the basis for human personality. So anyone who thinks the doctrine of the Trinity doesn't have any practical application hasn't at all thought about it, because anthropology is rooted in theology. And so we have that interpersonal relationship shown in "Let us." And there's been a lot of debate about whether that's a revelation of the Trinity or is it a plural of majesty. But the fact is that it's speaking about personality, however one might interpret that. And so, "Let us." And God speaks to Adam, doesn't he? He talks to him in the garden. So he's personally related to Adam. And so any other ways that you can think of that his personality is revealed there in those early chapters? I think that Packer sums it up nicely. He says he's a living person, thinking, feeling, active. He's approving the good and disapproving of sin. And he shows right at the beginning that he is always interested in us, in his image bearers, and especially since the fall, in his people. Always interested. And we see that even when Adam and Eve sin, what does he do? He goes after them. He promises them redemption, even as he judges their sin and folly in listening to and heeding the words of the serpent. Jen? Yeah, that's an excellent example. So the loneliness of Adam, which, how does he discover that? He discovers it in naming the animals. And, of course, he would name them according to their natures and what he observed in them. So that was a wonderful example, too, of human creativity made in the image of God. But he discovered that there was no animal. Dogs and cats won't make up for human presence, even though they're lots of fun. And so it was there that the Lord cared enough about him. And, of course, this was always in his plan, that he would make a woman to be his companion, and then from there on create many companions in the human race. So we have wonderful examples. Even he goes after Hagar in the wilderness when she has to flee the tyranny of Sarah and the jealousy of Sarah. And so those are loads of examples of those things that he shows. Now, then, how does he show his majesty? think about his majesty in those early chapters of Genesis. Of course, right off the bat, you've got majesty. Let there be light, and there was light. And so just creating everything out of nothing, we can only just barely begin to understand the majesty of God in the creation, calling all things out of nothing in the space of 6 days, and all very good. And so people sometimes make the mistake of saying 7 days of creation. No, 6 days. There was a day of rest, and that's very, very important, because in the 6 days, he creates man, puts man, male and female, in the garden, which, by the way, he plants. That's another very personal and wonderful thing that he did. And then he invites Adam and Eve to join him in Sabbath rest. But he doesn't get there because of sin and the fall. And, of course, the tree of life represents that Sabbath rest as well. And so the creation, right at the beginning, God is asserting, and there's a lot of literature. If you look at the literature of commentaries on Genesis and the nature of what's happening there, you see there's a large amount of scholarship that wants to push the idea that this was a book of apologetics. Now, I think that can be exaggerated. It's more than that. But it certainly is a stick in the eye of idolatry. I am God. I made everything out of nothing. Everything here, including the materials through or with which you make your idols, I made. I am the Lord. I am in control here. And I think that would have been a very dramatic and powerful thing when Moses wrote this book, which had been carried on by oral tradition up to the point when he wrote it there in the second millennium B.C. And so we have the creation, but then more than that, what happens when Adam falls? He is walking with God in the judgment day. It's not the cool of the day. That's actually a bad translation. And so this is when he meets the Spirit in judgment. And so God is personal because he goes after Adam and gives him a promise of redemption, but he's also the judge of all mankind. This is in his majesty. He is the judge, and he is the one before whom all human beings have to do ultimately. And so we also see that he is everywhere. You know, when Hagar flees from Sarah, God is there. So he's omnipresent. And he is also omnipotent. He is called El Shaddai. Now, this is actually in Exodus chapter 6, verse 3. He is called El Shaddai. And so El, of course, is the common Hebrew word for God. It would have been a common word in the culture to say God, the ultimate one. But Shaddai is in Hebrew, adds to that, that he is the Almighty One. And so he is the one who is in control of everything. And when he makes the promise that aging, they're more than octogenarians at this point, Abraham and Sarah are going to have a seed, Isaac. And Sarah, of course, laughs. And the Lord says, is anything too hard for the Lord? Is anything too hard for the Lord? That's just simply an expression of the fact that, no, nothing is too hard. If he created all things and is Lord of all things, then nothing is beyond his ability to do. And so he is in every way majestic. What two steps must we take to form a right idea of God's greatness? There are two steps here that he challenges us with in the book. Two steps. We've really already covered these, but now he's putting it in terms of a challenge that he wants us to flesh out. Look at Psalm 139. So what are the two things, though? There's a negative and a positive. This is before Psalm 139. That was a good stab. Isaiah 40 will be the next thing. But before that, he says, remove all things that limit God in our thinking about him. We, by nature, in our sinfulness, we think he's limited, even though we know theologically and biblically, because we're Christians, that he is unlimited. But we think of him as limited. He can't solve that problem that I have. He can't convert that unbelieving child. He can't help me to deal with this awful person at work. He can't. He can't? Really? So he's saying we need to go into our own thinking and eradicate those ideas that limit him. And then, positively, compare him with powers that we think are great. So that's a brilliant application. You can tell he's read a lot of Puritans because they were brilliant at application of biblical doctrine. In fact, they were rather blunt in the way they would construct their sermons. They'd have the doctrine and the application. You know, they had those two things. That was always the doctrine and the application. And we don't always preach in precisely that way, but those are the two basic ingredients of good biblical preaching. And so he's saying here that we've got to then take and what we think are great things, they may be persons or great things in the world, and compare God with them, and we'll see that he is greater. And of course, we can only learn this from the Bible. And then that's where we go to Psalm 139, which he does a beautiful job of picking this apart and showing us what this first step involves. And so how does it highlight, Psalm 139, how does it highlight his presence, his knowledge, and his power? How does it highlight those things? So first of all, and there, you know, you could quote a number of places in the psalm, but you might want to open up to Psalm 139 and take a look at this. So his presence. Right, exactly. So verse 7 sort of sums it up. You can't flee from God's presence because guess what? He is everywhere. He is omnipresent. You know, that word omni is a very useful one in theology. We think of omnibus. There used to be a program when I was a little kid that my parents watched called Omnibus. And I forget what it was about, but if we have a bunch of things before us in presbytery, we will have an omnibus motion will be that we put it all together in one motion and deal with it that way, all at once. And so omnipresent means that he is present everywhere. There's no place that God is not present. Think about that practically now. What if we really believe that, how will this affect our life of sanctification? God is always present. It will keep us from sin, right? Because so much of our sin is not observable to others, and that's why it's associated with darkness, things that are done at night when no one can see. Most theft takes place at night, though a few wise thieves decide that it's better to do that therefore in the day because no one expects it then. But sin is done in darkness, and also it starts within ourselves. It starts with desires, with thoughts, with our mental and inner life. And so if God is present everywhere, including inside of us and outside of us, then that has a powerful sanctifying effect. And it's something that we ought to remind ourselves every morning when we get out of bed that God is here. And I want to follow him by his grace and in light of his holy presence. And then in terms of knowledge. Now, it's interesting. It's not just what God knows here. As I picked up reading this, I made this mistake the first time I looked at that. It's God knowing us. And so where in that psalm do we see that he's knowing us? I picked 1 and 17, but yeah, 1 through 4, it's all about him knowing us. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. So that's scary. You know, I think C.S. Lewis says that, you know, the lion and the lamb, of course, are one, and he is not safe. In other words, the way we think of safe is that he'll just accept me the way I am and everything's fine. No, he's not safe. But of course, it is another sense in which he's absolutely safe. But we've got to be on his side, not he on ours. Idols are on our side. We fashion them to reflect our own sinfulness. But God calls us to be on his side through repentance and faith and through his grace forgiving us. And so this psalm is wonderful that way. It's like, that's scary. He knows me. But no, but then he knows me in his saving majesty, his grace. He knows me for my good. And even when I try to run, Jonah is escaping God. And God knew Jonah and searched Jonah and went out after him and made sure that Jonah came back to him. And especially that he did what he called him to do, which is to be a prophet to one of the enemies of Israel in Nineveh. modern Mosul, by the way, a very significant place in the world. And so that knowledge is wonderful. How precious, in verse 17, to me, are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. Now here, he's not only thinking about how precious are they that you know me. That's ultimately a good thing when we get beyond the fright. But also, how vast is the sum of them. It's all of what it means that God knows all things. And we see this how? Well, he is wonderfully and intricately wrought or crafted in the womb of his mother. So just that one thing shows how amazing God's thoughts are. They're astonishing, and they're especially astonishing in that you made me, who am made wonderfully. You know, no philosophy. I mean, in a sense, we should chuckle at, not in a cruel way, but chuckle at the atheists, these new atheists. They can't account for even what we are as human beings. They can't account for love, for fear, for those things. You can't account for those things based on their materialism. It's just not accountable. And in fact, there's a wonderful new book that was just reviewed recently. What this writer does, it's an InterVarsity book, and I'm going to get it and review it in Ordained Servant. He basically says, I'm not going to go and do arguments about God creating everything out of nothing. He believes that, but he's not going to go and argue that case. What he's going to do is show how biblical Christianity is the only true explanation for human life. It's the only true account of what we face every day. Which I think is a brilliant tack, actually, to take with modern people who are kind of locked into what happens to them every day. And then verse 14, I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. I like the King James. My soul knows it right well. And he's come to this conclusion as he comes near to the end of the psalm. And so he is powerful. And knows us intimately as he knows all things and he is ever present in our lives. If we look at Job, right before that famous passage that Carl mentioned a few minutes ago, 38 to 41, those are the chapters, is 37:22 that says, God is clothed with awesome majesty. And I notice that Packer quotes it in the King James, terrible majesty. Of course, we don't use that word terrible in the same way, and so awesome really is a better translation for modern people. Terrible we only take negatively instead of thinking about it as sort of wonderful and then frightening all at once. And so awesome, there's the way to use that word. Don't use it when you like the ice cream that your mother served you. That's not the right way to use the word awesome. It's a word that's been completely diminished. And it is a wonderful word to be used, especially with reference to God and his awesome majesty. Then he moves, finally, really, to Isaiah chapter 40. And he goes through five things that... So this is the answer to the second question then. Okay, we've got to look at things and get rid of thoughts that diminish God. And then we've got to go and we've got to positively compare God to other things in our lives, in the world, that we know are great. It's not just that we think they're great, but compared to God, they're little. And so he takes these five deeds, God's deeds, nations, the world, great ones, he refers to great people as great ones, and then the stars. And notice that in all five of these, when he gets done with his discussion after one or two paragraphs, he says, behold your God. I love the way he does that, just from literary perspective. He repeats that five times to impress upon us God's majesty. And so his deeds, all of this from Isaiah 40 and now verse 12, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens with a span, enclosed the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Whew. That's just amazing. In fact, it sort of sums up what Job does in those chapters from 38 to 41. We just watched last evening, we finished something we'd started earlier. and it's on K2. Forget the name of it, but it was about the 2008 disaster. And I always have enjoyed these as an amateur and minor mountain climber. Never been in the death zone and never ever hoped to go into the death zone. But in the death zone, guess what? People die. And what you see there, and I understand why people want to get to one of those summits. The best I've done is the Down to Midi in Switzerland and seen the Matterhorn and all the mountains. It's like the world is only snowy mountains. That's what you see from those summits. That's all the world is made up of. There are no cities, no people, nothing else, no trees. And it is majestic. And it's awesome. That is an awesome sight to stand on top of one of those mountains. You can do it without threatening your life, though, and going into the death zone. There are lesser mountains. And these people go into the death zone, and I just think, wow, if they don't know the Lord, they're flirting with death. And 11 people out of, I think, 28 died in 2008 in that death zone. And most of these people were highly skilled mountaineers. They really thought they knew what they were doing, but they didn't. And so God's amazing work of creation, his deeds. But notice that his deeds, a mountain is not greater than God. God who made the mountain and the mountains and everything else in the world that's wonderful, he's the one that is superlatively great. Nations then. Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are accounted as the dust on the scales. Behold, he takes up the coastlands like fine dust. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are accounted by him as less than nothing and emptiness. And of course, this is stated in a powerful way because, again, Isaiah is challenging. The temptation of Israel is to think that these nations now, which Assyria in this case, taken them captive, they're superior. And the Lord is saying, nations aren't superior. First of all, I created them. Secondly, I control them. And they are like a drop from a bucket. King James got that wrong. A drop in a bucket. Nope, it's less like you've got the bucket full and a little drop falls out on the ground when you're walking. And that's what he compares the nations to, something everyone in that culture would have experienced. They're nothing. I'm in control of them. And then in control of the world, verse 22, it is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to dwell in. And so, again, the created order is all in his control. And then next to the last, the penultimate thing to compare to God is the great ones. Verse 23, he brings princes to nothing and makes the rulers of the earth as emptiness. This is where that poetic form, ubi sunt, comes in. Where are they now? Ronald Reagan, I remember him, and I happened to, even while he was president, think he was one of the greatest presidents we've ever had. Now, actually, even liberal historians are recognizing this. But where is he now? He's dead. He had Alzheimer's at the end of his life. He turned out to be very, very mortal. And that's true of all great people that are presently alive. They are gone because they are mortal. And he brings princes to nothing. He can bring people down. Look at Muammar Gaddafi. Where is he today? He is dead. He was found in a pit. Probably not the smartest thing we ever did in terms of foreign policy, but there was a man in control of Libya for quite a while, a real tyrant, and he's gone. Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden, all gone. And then finally he says, look at the stars. So verse 26, lift up your eyes on high and see who created these. He who brings out their host by number, calling them all by name, by the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power, not one is missing. It's one of the things that we love to do from our campsite out in the western part of the state where there's very little light. In fact, where we have our campsite, there's no light at all. It can be scary, actually, if you're out there alone, which I sometimes do. But we always go out to the street, out where there are no trees, and we look up, and it's just completely stars on a clear night. There's nothing else. It's just thousands of stars that you can see from that point. And notice that when we're in New York City on our son Christopher's roof, you're lucky if you can see three. because the light pollution there is so powerful. But there you're reminded, and not one is missing. That's an amazing statement poetically to impress upon us God's majesty. And so the final question is, what three questions does Isaiah ask to the downcast Israelites? And what does each question rebuke? What can we do to be guiltless of each rebuke? And so this is sort of homework, since we're pretty much out of time. But here are the three questions. Who is like me? Who is like me? Isaiah 40:25. Our thoughts are simply too small when we think about God. And then question two would be, have I abandoned you? We oftentimes act as if God had abandoned us. And when they were in exile in Assyria, having been taken into captivity by an army like ISIS, we're so shocked by beheadings, and we should be. They're horribly barbaric. But this is the way armies like Assyria was known to be, the most barbaric army in the face of the world. And they came and took them away. That would be discouraging. To be taken away by a brutal army like that into a foreign place, and we're out of the land. Where are the promises of God? Has God abandoned us? And of course, he is telling them through Isaiah directly, no, I haven't. And in fact, one day I'm going to bring into the world a servant who will die for your sins and be raised again on the third day, and he will save you from sin and death, and glory will be your inheritance. And then finally, and this is in, see, that was verse 27. We're still in Isaiah 40. Finally, in 28, am I not majestic? We are slow to believe in his majesty. And so not only is his greatness, but we need to think in the details. And that's why he did those five things, to compare him to great things in the world. And by doing that, we can then ask ourselves the question, how should this affect our worship, our moral decision-making, and our prayer life? And so I'll leave those for you to contemplate. And go home this afternoon and read Job 38 to 41. Go home and read those four chapters aloud. And if you have kids that can read, involve them and do a dramatic reading is what the suggestion is.